Trek Profiles Podcast, Episode 9, recorded August 2018. This is the Trek Profiles Podcast, where each episode we sit down with a Star Trek fan. We learn their story and we try to figure out why this show matters to them, to you, and to all of us. I am John, your intrepid host of this whole enterprise, and I welcome you to this, the Trek Profiles Podcast, Episode 9. If you wish to get in touch with us, you can reach us at feedback@trekprofiles.com or on Facebook or Twitter at Trek Profiles. If you wish to leave us a voicemail, you can leave a message at our automated voicemail line at 609-512-LLAP or 609-512-5527. Spoiler warning! As we record this, we have reached the end of Season 1 of Star Trek Discovery, so all previous Trek content up to and including that point is fair game and may be discussed during this episode. You have been warned, human. With me is the magnanimous, monumental, multidimensional, and multitronic M5, my right-hand man.
M5 stands by.
Show me the messages, M5.
Acknowledged.
The Trek Profiles Podcast is a proud member of the Tricorder Transmissions Network. We have so many great shows, and we are about to launch a new one, Queer Trek, focusing on LGBTQ issues in Star Trek. Please be sure to follow us on Twitter at Tricorder Show for all of the latest on all of our shows. If you enjoy this or any of the shows on the network, please consider supporting the network on Patreon. Support at any level gets you access to extended and early releases, some uncut episodes, and admittance to our Patreon hangouts, which are always a blast. Another way you can support this or any of our shows is to visit the show page in iTunes and give us a nice rating and review. And if you aren't an iTunes user, that's okay too. We'd appreciate your rating and review in whatever platform you use. Those reviews help other fans find our shows, and we appreciate them so very much. Let's review the Kobayashi Maru questions from Episode 7 with Heather Barker. As a reminder, I tweet these out after each episode where you can have your say. Question 1. Pick the color you find most appealing. Doc Crusher teal, Data gold, or Riker red. Heather picked the teal, and so did all of you, by 44% to 39% for the red and 17% for gold. Question 2. You go to the Replimat for a snack, but it's broken. Only two options are available right now. Ferengi low-carb beans or preposterously large Jumja sticks. Heather picked the low-carb beans, but all of you most certainly did not want. The Jumja sticks won by an impressive 87%. I have to admit, I was surprised at the imbalance. Those Jumja sticks just look nasty to me. Some plain old beans seemed much more appetizing, but that's just me. Question 3. You need some counseling. Two counselors are available. Whom do you pick? Deanna Troi or Ezri Dax? Heather chose Dax, but the majority of you preferred Beta Z empath powers by 55 to 45%. Question 4. Time for some games. Will it be Fizbin with the Tuesday rules or Chula, but from the first Shap? Heather said Chula, but Fizbin won out 55 to 45%. Only children start at the first Shap, after all. Question 5. We have a moral conundrum for you here. The one and only Q appears and offers to save one of these two characters from certain death. Whom do you pick? Jadzia Dax or Tasha Yar? Now, Dax won by 83 to 17%, and Heather picked Dax also. But I will say that there was an interesting wrinkle that came up on Twitter about this question. If Jadzia was brought back, she would be alive, of course, and she would be herself, but she would not have the Dax symbiont. It would still be with Ezri. Would Jadzia even want to continue in this fashion? Or would your thought be to restore the symbiont to Jadzia, which would kill Ezri? I thought this was an interesting point, and this is the kind of fun we have on Twitter with these things, so feel free to weigh in as I tweet out the questions after each episode, and you can have your say as well. That's it for the messages and communiques. M5, it's time for the show. Let's roll it.
M5 will comply.
Her favorite character is a toss-up between Spock and Garak. Her favorite captain is Janeway, of course. The character she most loves to hate is Kai Winn. You can find her on the Twitter as Dr. Erin Mack and on the Facebook as Tattooed Gravity Girl. She's got double bachelor's in math and astrophysics from the University of Colorado and a PhD in astrophysics from the University of Glasgow. I think Scotty would approve. She joins us from the City of Angels, that's Los Angeles, California, North America, Earth in Sector 001. It's Dr. Erin McDonald. Welcome, Dr. Erin, and thanks for being on the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Dr. Erin, it's time for question one. Are you a Star Trek fan?
Yes, wholeheartedly. My many tattoos would indicate as well.
Have you been a lifelong fan, or is it something you came to later?
No, I actually came to it later. I try to kind of tell people, because I'm such a diehard Star Trek fan, that, you know, it's never too late to become one. And I never discovered it until I was actually kind of like late high school and college, where my circle of friends kind of were quite nerdy. I was a little bit of a loner up until I discovered until about high school. And then I started to meet a lot of kind of geeky friends. I joined the IB program. And so I got exposed to Star Trek through them. And then when I went to college and started studying physics, there's kind of like a big intersection in that Venn diagram of physicists and Star Trek fans. And so, you know, you'd go to parties at someone's house and there would be Star Trek on the TV while you're drinking out of red Solo cups. So that was kind of... It's a unique experience. And so, you know, just my love for it really grew, especially over those 4 years in college. And then just, you just spiraled from there.
You know, as an interesting aside, I remembered reading somewhere on the internet this web forum where it was, you know, ask an American, right? So people would ask questions of those of us who live here and then, you know, Americans would respond. And one of the questions was, what's with those weird red cups everybody's drinking out of in all the college parties? Is that a real thing? And everyone's like, doesn't everybody do that?
Yeah, right. Well, that's
red Solo cups. It's the universal symbol of the American collegiate experience right there.
It really is.
So tell me, what is your first memory of Star Trek?
Oh, that's interesting. So, you know, like I said, I never really grew up with it. My parents weren't super Star Trek fans, although they insist now that it's become such a big part of my life that, you know, I have to remember that they watched it when they were in graduate school in the 70s. But I didn't really catch any of the reruns. Like Voyager and Deep Space Nine were kind of on TV, but I was more obsessed with the X-Files. And then I think really my first big introduction was Nemesis when that came out.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I know, right? With zero context. And I said, like, my friends, you know, around that time, we went to go see it. And I just had zero context for what it was. So that's actually probably my closest memory. Although, you know, I do remember, like, my friend's house, my friend Molly, when we were growing up, her parents were big Star Trek fans. And so they had, like, pictures of Spock up. And I just had no sense for what it actually was. It was just always this thing in the background of my mind.
And so when did you finally decide that you were a fan?
Oh, so like I said, I mean, I think it was probably my junior or senior year of college when we would get to, you know, your friends, especially like physics. My graduating class, even though I was at the University of Colorado Boulder, the physics class was 17 people. It's a big college, but it's not a big graduating class. And so we would really get together and kind of do next generation drinking games. And around that time, I felt left out of the in-jokes. And this was back when you couldn't stream Netflix. You had to get the DVDs. That was the new big thing. And
yes.
Yeah. And so I ordered the DVDs of Next Gen and kind of watched those. I think at the discretion of my friends who were like, start with season 4. Don't even try. Like, we want you to enjoy it just so you can get the in jokes. You know, it's not a big thing. So I really enjoyed it then. But, you know, the part really just emotionally where I fell in love. I know this may be controversial, but the rebooted Star Trek movie came out the night we graduated. And
nice.
We graduated and then went to the midnight showing at the IMAX and we all got dressed up. And that was like my first exposure to Star Trek fandom. And that's when I was like, I have found my people. This is my thing. I belong with this crowd. And just, I mean, fell head over heels from that point on.
So would you consider the Kelvin Trek to be your Star Trek, or TNG?
No, actually, because around that time, so as I had, you know, I started discovering Next Gen, and then the Kelvin timeline has that strong memory for me. But I also started just in the side watching Voyager and Deep Space Nine. And then, I mean, I went immediately in when I graduated college, had that midnight showing. 3 weeks later, I was starting my PhD program in Scotland. So I had a 3 week turnaround to pack all my things, say goodbye to all my friends, and move alone to a new country. And that was when I started watching Voyager and Deep Space Nine. And I think it's that convergence of the universe, as it were, that, you know, it was hard and I was lonely and I just connected with it on a much deeper level than I had with Next Gen or the Kelvin movie, that especially having Janeway as a strong woman to kind of just hold my hand through that process. You know, this is it's a little bit like weirdly emotional to talk about, but you know, it is lonely when you do that. And I did feel like I was very isolated because I didn't know a single person. The closest family I had was at least an ocean away. And it kind of felt like being stuck in the Delta Quadrant. and so there was like just that relatability. Even if my mind, it wasn't that clear at the time, it wasn't like, oh my God, I'm alone in a country, they're alone in the Delta Quadrant, this is my thing. It was more just I was drawn to it. And on reflection, was able to make that connection. And, you know, so really, Voyager is my trek. You know, Deep Space Nine, I watched around the same time. I think like people who were Star Trek fans earlier watched it live. And I grew to like that more as a storytelling series. But if I have to talk to what's like the most emotionally deep in my core, it's definitely Voyager. And I have definitely gotten into like drunken bar arguments about like the merits of Janeway versus Picard. And, you know, I feel a real connection with that character, and I don't think that's ever going to leave. It's just never going to leave. So
I don't think there's any wrong answers there, right? Every little captain, every character, every series speaks to someone in a different way. And I think that's one of the joys of the fandom.
Yeah, absolutely.
My question for you, though, is that it seems like when you were in Colorado, you had a group of people around you who were very much into Star Trek. And if I understood you right, when you're over in Scotland, you were very much alone. So you didn't connect with Star Trek people over there. And so you consumed it pretty much by yourself. Is that right?
No. Well, actually, I started out by myself. But that's when I started getting into it more and started exploring other series. And, you know, I had, in the course of college, I'd been exposed to the original series episodes, and I liked Spock, and I liked, you know, the characters in that. And then, you know, the Kelvin timeline kind of made that connection with the original series for me a little bit stronger. I knew who the characters were, and actually, it was interesting because I started, you know, watching Voyager and all of that by myself. But a few months in, I started connecting more with another woman who was a postdoc. She was doing research. She was by herself. She had moved there from Switzerland for a short contract. She had a partner back in Switzerland, so she was kind of alone. And we would get together on Friday nights, and we would watch Star Trek, the original series, and we would alternate because my boy was Spock, her boy was McCoy. And so we would alternate our favorite episodes, and we would drink wine and eat takeout curry and watch the original series. And that was probably like Friday night at least once a month. And so, you know, I talk about how Star Trek has that ability, like within the series, like internally to teach us a lot, but it also has that ability to externally connect us with people that we may not have made a connection with the first time around. So, and then there was another woman on the program who I actually got to know at a party, I think like Christmas. So this was like 6 months into my program. But we started talking about strong female characters that we liked, and we bonded over the fact we both really liked CJ in The West Wing, and then started sharing other characters. And I brought up Janeway, and she brought up B'Elanna Torres, and her background had been in engineering. And so we had a really good discussion about what it meant to be women in science, but being drawn to two different characters within the same series and how awesome it was that we even had that choice.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. And I could see that, right? Is that you see yourselves in these characters and it pulls you in. I think it's great. So it seems like you came to Trek a little bit in dribs and drabs in different places in your life. But as we record this today, have you seen all 700 and something hours of it?
Oh my God, yeah, all of it. Definitely all of it. I think maybe the only thing I've not watched twice is the last season of Enterprise, and I'm going through a rewatch of that right now. So we'll catch up.
Even the animated series?
Even the animated series. Thank you, Netflix, for putting it on.
Perfect, perfect. So let me ask you about that. So when you choose to rewatch, are you a disciplined rewatcher? Like you watch whole seasons like straight through, or do you pick and choose?
Oh, it depends on what I'm in the mood for. There are definitely some of my go-to episodes that if I'm sick or just need cheering up or, you know, whatever I'm in the mood for, I may pick an episode. If I want to rewatch, if I'm in the mood to rewatch Deep Space Nine, I tend to just watch that beginning to end. If I feel like watching Next Gen or original series, I rewatch those a lot, but I pick and choose the episodes. I'm actually doing sort of a series with a friend of mine right now. She's never watched Star Trek before. I actually started her on Voyager because that was kind of my first beginning to end series watch that made me fall in love with Star Trek, and started her with Voyager, and actually it seems to have been a really good choice, and we just finished it. And so we're going to watch Next Gen beginning to end again for me again.
Nice.
Her for the first time.
So you're recruiting people into the fold, I see.
Oh, heck yeah, for sure. I think, like, because I don't shut up about my fandoms. And, like, even just my tattoos, you know, people will see me on the street and be like, well, what's that from? I'm like, oh, that's Live Long and Prosper in Vulcan. And it starts a conversation.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
So since you brought it up, you've got some Star Trek tattoos.
I do.
Please tell us about them if you feel comfortable doing so. And,
yeah.
And why did you choose what you did?
Yeah. So the first one that I got was actually in those 3 weeks before I left for Scotland. And I have to say, I have had tattoos before then. This was probably my 10th or so tattoo. But I went and got just the original series command badge. But we all went after that midnight showing and went and got tattoos. And I chose to get a Star Trek tattoo. We didn't all get the same ones. But that for me was such a special night that I wanted to commemorate it with Star Trek. Star Trek was really the central focus of that evening, and that meant a lot to me. And I knew that that was the beginning of something. Like I said, just seeing other fans at that midnight showing and realizing that Star Trek fandom was where I belonged was definitely something I wanted to commemorate. And then, let me think, what was the next one? Oh, then the next one, I think after that, was I got a series of tattoos down my arm that are all just black and white symbols, but they're symbols from my favorite fandoms that mean a lot to me. And then the quote that says, it's a human need to be told stories, which is a quote from Alan Rickman that I got when he passed away. And the first three symbols in that are the Idix symbol and the Vulcan Idix symbol, the House of Martok, and then the Voyager Deep Space Nine Delta comm badge signal symbol.
Nice.
Yeah. And then the next one I got is Live Long and Prosper in Vulcan script down the outside of my forearm that I had planned for a long time. I had planned it when Leonard Nimoy died and was really happy to finally get that. And I think, again, when you were asking me about like my first memories of Star Trek, you know, really those images of Spock in my friend's house. You know, Spock is so integral to what Star Trek is, and just losing Leonard Nimoy hit me a lot harder than I expected it to be. And so I wanted to commemorate that somehow. And then the last one I got 2 weekends ago at Star Trek Las Vegas.
Nice.
And I just got it was a little bit impulsive, but I got the Delta comm badge just in like sort of a scrawled marker type thing on my shoulder, just a little tiny piece. Just to commemorate that weekend, because it was a big, big weekend for me.
Oh, fantastic. What shop did you go to?
The one in there, the Counts Tattoo Parlor, whatever it was.
No, the one that's in the Rio?
Yeah, the one in the Rio, yeah.
Okay, cool.
This says what kind of like headspace I was in. I was like, oh, I need a tattoo. I need to commemorate this.
it's amazing, right, to explain. I was trying to explain to people, and this has come up on the show before. I was talking to another person who lives here in town, and because I live in Vegas, if you didn't know. And we were talking about the fact that we both lived here, and we'd gone to the convention previously, but we'd gone home at the end of the day. And we talked about how the whole experience changed when we actually stayed in the hotel.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And it's like going away to college versus taking a couple of classes at the community college down the block. It's not quite the same thing.
For sure. You know, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Let's talk about the conventions for a minute. So when did you start going to Star Trek conventions?
So I actually started, my first convention that I went to was Dragon Con. For those who may not be familiar, it's not about dragons. It's a pop culture sci-fi fantasy convention that's held in Atlanta on Labor Day weekend every year. And my friends and I went, we actually were, I need to rephrase that. I did go to conventions when I was a little kid with my Uncle Mike. He actually lived in San Diego and took me to Comic-Con in the 90s when it was not what it is now. But that was like minimal exposure to that sort of world. That was the closest I ever got for a long time. And then when I was older and obviously like kind of had become more secure in my fandom and my nerdiness, then we were looking for my friends and I were looking for conventions to meet up at after I had gone off to graduate school and try to do like a bit of a reunion for my college friends. And we found Dragon Con, and that is a beast of a convention. It's still like far and away just insane. It's in five hotels for Labor Day weekend, so Thursday through Monday. It's 96 hours, and it's 96 hours of programming. And so that was my first convention ever. And then actually this past...
I do just have to give a plug, by the way, for our listeners. If you want to learn more about Dragon Con, I think we actually did a special on our Shore Leave podcast on this network with some people who've been involved with Dragon Con. So it gives a total break. I mean, it's like 2.5 hours of just talking about, you know, how it works and the different hotels and, you know, the whole process and how wildly different it is from STLV and all that.
For sure. Yeah, that's good because it is a different beast. And I'm very, you know, I started, that's actually how I got my start speaking at conventions was through Dragon Con. And then from there, it just spiraled because I started speaking at conventions and went on from there. And then actually this past Star Trek Las Vegas was my first ever only devoted Star Trek convention. And I was just so excited. My poor work colleagues were just like, oh my God, Aaron, shut up about this. I was so excited just to, because all these other conventions will have Trek panels or they'll have Trek tracks that you could still devote a good chunk of your weekend to Star Trek. And I would still dress up and I would still, you know, wear a Janeway uniform, but this was my first ever Star Trek convention. So it was fun. It was a big deal.
so you never actually went to STLV just as an attendee. You were an actual speaker the first time you went.
Yeah. That was something of a personal goal of mine that I wanted that to be I had picked out that convention because I had heard so much about it and my speaking engagements were ramping up that I just kind of told myself, I was like, you know, I'm going to work toward that. I'm going to, you know, just really work hard and try to get my name out there and just network and meet people. And just, I would like a personal goal of mine to be the first time I go to Star Trek Las Vegas to be as a speaker, and mission accomplished.
That's right. And in fact, that's how actually I encountered you was I went to your panel and I was live tweeting it and taking pictures. And I this is for the listeners who might be interested or may not be, I don't know, but you know, bear with me here a second. And so I waited afterwards to come talk to you and that we had a little chat and that's when I invited you on the show. So that's how all this came to be. But I just thought it was a great panel. So why don't we just recap just very briefly some of that content that we talked about? What was the subject of your panel at STLV?
Well, so I actually gave a couple talks. The first one was on Friday morning. So I talked about the physics in Star Trek. And this is a talk that I've been taking to conventions this year, but it was really special for me to be able to do it at STLV. And it goes into warp drives, transporters, all the technology that exists that where we are in actual, like, any physics behind it. And it's fun and lighthearted. You know, I do a lot of science of science fiction, and my point isn't to destroy it or ruin it for anyone. I'm as much of a fan as anyone else. So instead of saying, like, well, this is wrong or this can never be, it's like, well, you know, we don't have that yet. And this is the physics that would help that to happen. So yeah, so I did that on Friday. And then on Sunday was the Star Trek Discovery panel that I did, the science of Star Trek Discovery, and just kind of set that aside as a separate series. Mostly just because there may have been a lot of fans who hadn't seen it yet. I didn't want to throw in a lot of physics of Discovery into the other talk, just because there are a lot of spoilers in it. So I had that as a separate talk, and it was really fun. It was really fun. I did a live stream when Discovery aired. A couple days after every episode, I did a live stream where I broke down the science of every episode, not knowing what was coming. And having been previously kind of touted as like a warp drive and faster than light travel expert, they really threw me a curveball. So it was entertaining.
With the spore drive?
Yeah. God. I know more about spores and mycelial networks and tardigrades than I ever thought I would.
Well, without getting too deep into it, what's your thought? Thumbs up midway or thumbs down on the spore drive?
Oh, on the spore drive? Thumbs down. For sure. I can kind of explain it away, but it's biology in space. You know, that doesn't work. And then it also supposedly transverses the universe. And this is something, a bit of a pet peeve of mine that you see in a lot of science fiction, is that the solar system, the galaxy, and the universe are sort of like city, state, and country. And those get interchanged a lot. And so this idea that the spore drive intersperses our entire universe is a little bit hard to get on board with. You know, but that being said, I have definitely spent a long time trying to explain it, trying to justify it.
As a layperson, I've got two provocations for you I'd like you to respond to, since we're now on the topic of physics and Star Trek.
Okay.
One of the things that I'm just aware of, even with just my amateur's understanding, is the vastness of space. On, you know, the distances are of such a scale that it's like incomprehensible for an average person to even get their brain wrapped around it. And that's right. My understanding, right? So I feel pretty confident in that. So one of the things that always takes me out of the episodes is when we keep running into the same people and the same things over and over again.
Oh, right. Right.
It's like,
yeah,
that space virus we encountered 4 episodes ago, or 3 series in 4 episodes ago, or something, or the same family in the same ships.
Exactly. Yeah, space is really big. I like to joke that astrophysicists live in a constant state of existential crisis, because it's insane how big space is. And you're absolutely right. The probability of running into like the same people. I used to have a sign up when I was leading a team of researchers that just said, I think it was pictures from the original series and from Next Gen, where the original series is like, we found like a hole. It looks like a hole in space. And then the Next Gen, they're like, it seems to be like a hole in space. Have we encountered something like this before? And they're like, no, Captain. And I'm like, this is why we keep logs, people.
Yeah, it's they have not been so strong in the continuity game between all the different series, for sure.
In a lovable way. So, yeah.
As a person who studied physics, though, let me ask you this question by telling you a story and have you respond to it. And I've had this experience twice in my life in 2 different contexts. I like to read, but I like to read nonfiction. Fiction doesn't really do it for me. So I like to read all kinds of interesting books, and I like to read books about like things that I don't even have an interest in doing. So I'd been in a bookstore and I picked up this book on how to write scripts. And one of the interesting things about the book is that when I opened it up, inside there was a user warning. And it basically said, don't read this book, because this book is not for you if you just want to read it and be nosy. This book is for people who are desperately trying to break into Hollywood or to any place where you're going to write scripts. And I'm going to show you horrible hacks, shortcuts, and ways to get your script bought that are really shortcuts. And they're things that when you know about them, when you see them in a show, you're going to immediately see them and it's going to pull you out of the show and you'll never be able to enjoy TV again.
Wow. Yeah. Danger, Will Robinson.
And I read the exact same warning with different words when I went into a magic shop and wanted to learn how to do some magic tricks. And they said, you'll never be able to enjoy a magic show for the rest of your life because now you're going to know some things. So proceed at your own risk and just know that you're cutting this part of your life out. And you know what? It was totally true.
Wow.
I read the book, and when I see the things that they do, especially in like lower budget shows, I think, oh, that's that thing that he was talking about. Oh, I see what he did there. Oh, that's why they didn't have to reset the lighting. Oh, I totally get why that happened. And it's like, it takes you out of the show. Now, I have to imagine as a person who is seriously trained in astrophysics, I would think that sometimes when they start getting into, you know, the gluon particles and, you know, tachyon streams and spore drives, does it take you out of the show the way that it happened to me, or have you been able to resist that? Talk to me about that.
You know, it's funny because you would think that that disclaimer would come with anyone who's a science fiction fan trying to get a science degree. And they don't give you that disclaimer. But I think it's a broad spectrum. You know, for me, I am able to kind of take a step back and go, okay, this is a story and this is fun. But I have a ton of other colleagues. My dad as well, he's a scientist, cannot do that. He cannot watch science fiction, just doesn't enjoy it, sees the problems in it, and is just incapable of letting go of reality. For me, I see it as a challenge, right? My dream was to, like, you know, become a Starfleet, you know, when I'm going through undergrad, I wanted to join Starfleet. And for me, I was like trying to put off writing my thesis and my dissertation. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm getting a degree in general relativity. Like, I bet I can figure out how warp drive works. And so sat down and didn't work on my thesis for a while and tried to figure out how warp drive would work. And that's kind of what got me into that realm. And so for me, I see a lot of stuff as a challenge. Now, the stuff that does annoy me, that does throw me out of a movie or a show or anything like that, is when it's, I don't want to say lazy, but it's like easily Googled, you know, that something like the difference between our solar system and our galaxy and the universe is conflated everywhere. So that's something people think they understand and they don't. And so that mistake is common and it annoys me, but I'm willing to let it go. It's when you have, you know, let me think, for example, you know, maybe just some basic facts about like our solar system that are a throwaway thing about, you know, maybe, okay, for example, I'm not thinking of any science fiction in particular when I'm saying this, but something as simple saying like, oh, they landed on the surface of Jupiter, you know, and you're like, well, Jupiter doesn't have a surface, guys. Like, it's a gas giant. and those sort of kind of basic science things do come up occasionally. I think Star Trek is one of the better ones. I will say that Discovery did give me that initial reaction with the spore drive, because I was like, it's a vacuum in space. And just because we've noticed that tardigrades have been able to live in space for like 30 days doesn't mean you can have giant space tardigrades. So, because like ultimately you still need oxygen. And that being said, though, it was more the spore drive itself that annoyed me, because it's a fungus. And the vacuum of space and fungi are not very co-compatible. I'll put it that way.
So without any knowledge of any of the science involved, which I freely admit, I recommended this before, and I know there's probably a couple listeners out there who've listened to every episode, have probably heard me say this like four times now. But Joe Rogan, who is certainly not everyone's cup of tea, but he did an interview with the real Paul Stamets, the real scientist, the real mycologist. And he did a 3-hour interview talking about this stuff. And the guy is definitely trippy and mind blowing. And I understand that they actually consulted with him. And I am not in any way saying that there's real physics or real FTL travel or anything like that. But I can say I immediately understand how, if you're a group of writers and this guy gets on the phone, you're like thinking about possibilities, you know, because he is like way out there and it's definitely a trip.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I've definitely been pointed to his stuff. And like you said, I think I can see the writing merit of it. I think from an astrophysics standpoint, it's a little bit harder.
So, but you've been able to resist the feeling of getting sucked out of things.
For the most part, yeah. You know, another great example is The Martian. You know, there's one giant science flaw in The Martian. And
the book or the movie or both?
Both. That winds on Mars are high velocity, but they don't have the force to knock over a satellite or a communication relay to injure Mark Watney. They just don't. The air pressure on Mars is 0.6% of what it is on Earth. And so it's effectively a vacuum. And so you can have particles moving at very high speeds, but there's just not the density to be able to have actually any force. It's the visibility that's the problem. But that being said, if they didn't knock over the communication relay, there would be no movie. So, you know, that's when I pause for a second and then I go, okay, let's ride with this. And I really enjoy it.
I totally get you. I think that in every sort of sci-fi world, you have to give them at least maybe two things. You're just going to press the I believe button on and move on, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, it becomes impossible.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you mentioned that you have a Janeway cosplay. Do you have any other cosplays that you've done?
For Star Trek, no. Janeway's my girl. I don't think there are enough Janeway cosplays out there. Dragon Con does a Star Trek photo shoot every year, and I do it every year as Janeway. And more times than not, I'm the only one. So I am always there for my girl. I was pleased to see how many Janeways there were at STLV, though. I gotta say, there were a lot, which was awesome.
So it's one thing to do the Janeway uniform, but do you do the Janeway bun of doom?
The Janeway bun of death and steel. Oh my gosh, that bun. Yes, I do. And it's a pain. Yeah, it's my hair turns into a rock. This year, my hair might be short enough to actually do the bob. So I will see if I can pull that off. If not, we're pulling out the hairspray.
Fantastic. Fantastic. It's funny because as my Twitter followers have grown and as I've become more prolific in my tweeting, I did the same cosplay at STLV the last 2 years in a row. I don't know if you saw, I was at the black and white guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I was marching around with my friend Robin, and we were the followers of Lokai from
nice.
Let That Be Your Last Battlefield. Yeah. But we have a whole thing we do where we don't talk, we don't laugh, and we're protesting. So like it's a thing, you know?
Right.
And we have all this tude. And my Twitter followers this year, one of them in particular was like, you need to cosplay this guy. And I forget the name of the character, but it's in Star Trek Generations? No,
okay.
Insurrection. I think it's the Bolian Admiral at the beginning who's chasing around Picard saying, have you read my paper on thermionic transference? And, you know, because
awesome.
he's bald, I'm bald, you know, and I could do like the blue headed thing. And I was like, I don't know if I will consent to this. Cerulean is not my color. I don't know how I feel about this. It's a whole thing. So
that's amazing.
We'll see what we do.
I love
it.
Yeah,
we'll see what we do. We'll see what we do next year. I don't know.
That's very cool. Yeah, I also do a lot of Princess Leia cosplays. I do a lot of Leia through the series cosplays. Those are fun.
The hair buns?
The hair buns. And then I also, my favorite one is Hoth. Hoth Leia.
Nice.
Yeah. And so those only really come out at Dragon Con, though, because those are the ones that's the convention I have the time to go back to my hotel room, get dressed up and come back down, because it'll be like 9-10 o'clock at night and the party's only getting started. So, yeah, after my talks are done during the day.
But what does it do for you? Like, why do you put on the uniform? Why do you do the Janeway? I mean, I know you love Captain Janeway. I know she's your captain. But what does it do for you to put on the uniform?
It's empowering, for me. It feels, you know, there's something that just lifts my chin, straightens my back, and I feel powerful. And even if my cosplay is not perfect, I'm not a professional cosplayer, you know, but I get in that bun of steel, I've got my captain's pips on, it feels awesome. And I feel like I'm honoring a character. I'm able to embody the character. I feel closer to that character. Yeah, it's a really powerful experience to be able to embody a character you feel so close to.
Do you collect anything, whether it's books or trinkets or plates or props or anything like that?
Other than tattoos. I really don't. It's interesting, though, because a friend of mine, she was actually my history teacher in high school. I was a big nerd anyway. Like, Star Trek was later in life, but I was, like, hardcore Star Wars, Harry Potter, like, all of the things. And we reconnected later because she does Cold War history. And she grew up watching the original series. And so when the 50th anniversary of Star Trek came around, I invited her to do a talk with me where I talked about the context of Star Trek when it first aired. And I talked about the scientific and space exploration context. And she talked about the historical context. And it was really fun. And it brought us really close together. And she doesn't have any kids. And she actually has a giant Star Trek collection, and she's retired, and her husband are going off and exploring the world and kind of, you know, taking care of their effects before they go. And she gave me all of her cups and plates from like the years, and it's an amazing collection. And she just told me, she was like, you know what? She's like, I don't care if you want to sell this. I don't care if you want to keep it. She's like, but you're the person that I know will honor it in whatever way you need to. And so I personally don't collect, but I have a heck of a collection that's been gifted to me, and I honor it and I keep it careful and safe.
Do you display it, or is it tucked away?
Right now it's tucked away. I don't have the space to give it the honor it deserves. It's a big collection. And so I don't want to put parts of it out. I want to be able to display the whole thing. So I certainly have a plan for it. The other thing is that it is plates and glasses, and I live in Southern California. And right now, if an earthquake hits, they're okay. If they're displayed, I need to make sure that I have the funds to get an appropriate case that will keep them safe.
It makes total sense. I had an aunt that had a plate collection, not of any kind of sci-fi fantasy thing, but of other kinds of plates. And she had them affixed to the wall with like these wire holders.
Oh, wow.
So pretty much her whole wall would have had to have collapsed for anything to have happened to any of that stuff. So I totally get you on that. There's a question that I've talked about with some of the guests. It's come up lately. I want to offer it to you and see how you respond to it. You talked about when you were in college in Colorado that you were watching Star Trek with your university classmates, and you were probably watching it in the dorm or one of the apartments or something that somebody had. And you were talking about the fact that, you know, you sort of had to watch the episode that was picked for you because you were watching it either in syndication and then you had the DVDs. Do you feel that your reaction to how you're watching Star Trek changes if you're binging it straight through or if you're watching it episode by episode with a time in between to sort of digest it?
You know, yeah, I watched them in pieces, not in order. Like you said, at whatever was chosen was watched. And it was typically people who, you know, at their house, they had the VHS or DVD, I think new DVD collection. And so they'd pick their favorite ones. And so I was exposed to some of the greatest ones. And then when I went to watch it myself, there are a lot of episodes that are not great. I was like, oh, okay. So we're rolling. We're okay with this. But you know, that was, I think going in that order made me appreciate the good ones more, if that makes sense. But then I've also talked to friends. So then I watched Voyager and Deep Space Nine for the first time, like you were talking about binging beginning to end. That was the first exposure I ever had to either of those series, was season one, episode one, all the way through. And but then I talked to friends of mine who were watching Voyager or Deep Space Nine when it was airing and were catching episodes here and there. They weren't devoted fans, or, you know, they miss a week. And they said they appreciate especially Deep Space Nine much more, being able to see the full story arc. I think there are those odd episodes where you're like, wait a minute, like there was something quite serious going on and now you're having an adventure on the holodeck. Like, that doesn't make sense. But I think some of those friends, they had never really pieced together the war with the Gamma Quadrant until they watched it beginning to end, because they weren't sure which order they were seeing which episodes. And then appreciated that story a lot more. So I don't think there's a right way to first get exposed to it. I think, you know, my friend who's watching Next Gen for the very first time, season one, episode one, is struggling a little bit. and she said that it helped that she's watched Voyager because she kind of appreciates where it's going but she's not sure if she would have stuck with it. So at least that's so the impression I get so far. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I'm conflicted in several different ways when it comes to Discovery. Let me start by offering a comparison. So I watched the show Sons of Anarchy on FX. I don't know if you ever saw it, but it's that show about the bicycle gang, the bike gang.
I've never seen it, but I know of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's an incredibly, you know, it's a modern show in that it's a heavily, heavily serialized show where every episode relies heavily on plot threads from the show before, right? And there's a lot of shows like that now. But it's one of these shows where, like, I watched it in live broadcast, and I couldn't keep track of, like, who was double-crossing who, and who was this guy, and who is that guy. And, like, they make reference to something that happened three seasons ago, and they're like, that's why I got to kill this guy. And I'm like, what was that thing? And I felt like I had to have a Wikipedia page open just to follow the episodes at some point. And I think that as Star Trek goes into this 21st century mode with Discovery and the new things that are coming, I'm wondering how much of that is going to be influenced. Because, for instance, like with Discovery, right, whether you like it or don't like it or feel indifferent, it certainly is one show told over the course of a season. And it's harder to analyze it on an episodic basis, for sure. But at the same time, I appreciated the fact that as a fan, we got time in between every episode to talk about it and analyze it and mind meld each other over it and, you know, all that. And, you know, sort of have our Trek fandom moment. So I'm not sure how I feel about that yet.
Yeah. You know, I thought about that a lot. And I think just a few thoughts on Discovery. You know, I was reticent at first, but I think in the same way I was when I started watching Deep Space Nine after I had watched Voyager, that, you know, it had heavily religious overtones. It was on a station. I wasn't personally wild about some of the acting in the first episode, and it's now my favorite series. So that kind of kept me going through it. And then also thinking about it, I was like, well, all right, let's think about the series, you know, the later series of Star Trek. And I would include Enterprise in this. Like, Enterprise and Deep Space Nine and Voyager particularly all have, well, Voyager kind of has a series long arc of just trying to get home, but Deep Space Nine and Enterprise have arcs, significant story arcs. And if you took out the filler episodes, you'd probably end up with 13 or 14 episodes. And I think that's kind of what they're doing with the Discovery, is that they're taking out those filler episodes and giving us 13 to 14, so, you know, however many, to tell one story. So we're not getting the fun holodeck episodes anymore. We're not getting the weird side adventures. I do like that they did have an episode that was entirely a landing, you know, landing party mission.
Oh, yes. With the Povans.
Yeah. And so they did kind of give us some of that. So, you know, the more I watch it, the more I'm on board with it. And I think something that has really sold me on it is how devoted the cast and crew have been to it, that they are excited about being a part of it. They want to do it justice. They want to do it right. They're engaging with fans. And I really like that. That speaks volumes for me.
This might be a diversion, but we can talk about it if you want. One of the things that I notice is just being someone who's engaged with the fandom on social media, and I know that you are as well, although to what degree, you can certainly feel free to characterize for yourself. I appreciate that there are some fans who may not like Discovery for any number of reasons. Most of those reasons, in my just observation, seem to be related to things like, you know, how tied in it is or not to canon, and the visual look of the show and the new Klingons and these things that people are beating it up for. And, you know, I'm not even going to take a position on that. But the thing that I thought was interesting was, you know, there are some people who say, well, I don't like Discovery, therefore, I hate you, actor, who were on Discovery. And yeah. I thought, well, these two things have nothing to do with each other, right? I mean, actors, they learn their lines, they show up, they hit their marks, they do their job, you know, and if the writing's not good, that's not them.
Yeah. And I don't get it. No, I think that's where we are as a society right now with the advent of being able to engage directly with the actors. You know, I think that is probably something that has been a part of fandoms for a long time, but then people don't have the opportunity to actually engage with the actors. You know, it's like this cognitive dissonance that you're you're associating the actor and the person in your mind, or the actor and the character in your mind as one and the same. And maybe people have been doing that forever. It's just now this is the first time they can tweet at the actor. You know, people weren't going out of their way to write hate fan mail. I mean, they were, but not nearly to the extent they write hate Twitter.
They totes were.
So, you know, that's never changed. And I think Twitter just escalates that. And any other opportunity, Instagram or any of that other stuff gives that venue for those discussions. So yeah, I mean, I'm with you. It's a job for them, but I think a lot of people just don't understand it and maybe just haven't put the time into it. It's a lot easier to write a hate tweet than it is to analyze the working life of an actor. So
I get you there, Dr. Aaron. Well, I think you can dislike Discovery if you want, but you have to love the staff because they seem like just the most lovely people. So I totally endorse what you were saying there. So one of the things that I did in preparation for the show was I sent the M5 out to do some gentle internet sleuthing, or perhaps not so gentle, and to analyze all of your social media and other publicly available information about you, Dr. Aaron. And the M5 has given me a list of episodes that he feels we should discuss. So are you ready for an episode discussion?
Bring it on. Can't wait.
All right. Well, since we were talking about Discovery, why don't we start there? So the M5 is telling me that we should talk about Into the Forest I Go, and that this is a particularly significant episode in your estimation. So why don't you tell me why the M5 is right in this particular regard?
Absolutely. So this is the mid-season finale of the first season of Discovery, and this is when they're trying to find the ways to detect the cloaked Klingon ships. Now, being a science of sci-fi person and also someone who was actively analyzing the science in Discovery as it was airing, blew my mind, blew my little gentle mind, because like I had mentioned before, my doctorate was in general relativity, and that includes things like, space-time, that's the shape of our universe, that's gravitational waves was particularly what I was working on, and gravitational lensing is a big part of that. It's a lot of evidence that gave us proof prior to detecting gravitational waves that Einstein's theory of general relativity was correct. This is that bowling ball on the trampoline idea, where you can see an image being bent around another massive object. The light gets bent around. And what they did in Discovery and in this episode is that they came up with a way to detect cloaked Klingon ships by the background light being lensed around them. But it's such a micro level, it would require them to do multiple jumps and take multiple pictures in order to resolve the cloaked ship.
And 133.
And I was like, yeah, that's perfect. That's brilliant. That's how I would do it.
Nice.
And so just as a scientist, I thought that was probably, I mean, I'm hugely biased in this, but with my personal background, that is my 100% of all of Star Trek combined favorite scientific explanation that they've ever come up with, because it was so spot on. It was
nice.
Perfect. Yeah.
Do you know, by the way, I don't know if you know this trivia, that there's a specific reason they chose 133? Did you know this?
I have heard this, but refresh my memory.
It's a reference back to the reimagined Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, the 33 minutes. Was that it?
Yes. The very first episode of the actual show, not the pilot / miniseries, but the first hour long sci-fi episode was 33. And it has a reference to do with these 33 minutes. And so they made it 133 jumps. And it was kind of a very subtle, like seven layers deep reference to something that was connected through Ron D. Moore, who also worked on Star Trek. So
right.
really cool. So I just love that. So, you know, you always get something a little extra with the John show when you tune into Trek Profiles. So there you go. You really enjoyed that. Mirror Universe. As a physicist, how do you feel about this whole concept of the Mirror Universe? Yes, no. Don't know.
So another talk that I gave last year at conventions was on multiverse theory in science fiction. And the mirror universe is just a fairly basic standard explanation for a multiverse. It's this idea that we have our fabric of space-time that is the trampoline, and you just multiply everything by -1, and then you get a mirror universe. And, you know, we talk about infinite universes. There's a lot of different types of multiverses that physicists are like legitimately have theorized about or are trying to actively detect, though it's hard to figure out how we would actually detect them. But this idea that you have just a other universe, a so-called mirror universe, is possible. Now, how you would travel in between that is a different thing. But, you know, I always like the mirror universe stuff, and I'm good with it. It doesn't anger me. As a viewer, it's enjoyable.
I have to admit, I'm in awe because no, it's true. We talked earlier about the fact that when I read that script writing book and when I went into that magic shop, you know, and I had those user warnings, right? I'm not smart enough to be able to separate my reactions. And, you know, it's really funny, actually, as we record this, just a couple days ago, I got in a very long Twitter discussion, and it was a polite discussion. It was a good discussion, and I'm glad we had it. I was watching Deep Space Nine, and we got to the episode where Dukat was about to bring the Jem'Hadar reinforcements through the wormhole.
Oh, yeah.
And the Federation was, you know, trying to fight it, but they were losing. And Sisko goes into the wormhole and convinces the prophets to eliminate the Jem'Hadar, right? And I was saying on Twitter that, like, I didn't like the fact that in the middle of the battle that Dukat went into his ready room and started having cocktails and had a long discussion with Wei Yun. And someone on Twitter was, you know, respectfully, you know, and very passionately defending the opinion that, well, that was totally in character. And I said, you know what? I get that you think it's in character. The problem I have is that I'm a veteran.
Right.
Having drinks in the middle of combat operations is militarily incompetent. It's dereliction of duty. It's blah, 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 blah. And I went on this whole thing. And the guy's like, yeah, but it's totally in character for Dukat. And I'm like, So you're saying he's militarily incompetent and a bumbler. And if that's true, it makes him a less good villain. And Deep Space Nine is lessened for that. Like, if the villain is no good, the show is less good.
Yeah, interesting.
And yeah, we got this whole discussion about it, right? But I couldn't. And they're like, well, you're thinking too much about it, you know? And, you know, it's totally in character. And, you know, we had a good discussion. I don't mean to mischaracterize the other person's opinions, right? You know, he was very passionate about it. And I respect his opinion. But I was unable to escape my own thoughts as a former military person about what I thought about it. You know, that he was having Kanar with Wei Yun, you know, in the middle of the battle. And I was like, nope. You know, like, well, he's not even a human. He's a Cardassian. And I was like, doesn't matter.
it's so funny that you say that because my partner is a former Marine. And his problem when we watch, especially Star Trek, is the military stuff. He's like, why are you sending like a pilot to go on a security mission? Like all these sort of, you know, assignments and just the view from the military. And we've had that exact discussion about how that's his background. That's the stuff he catches. I catch the science stuff that he wouldn't catch. And I love that we're able to see it through each other's eyes. And that's a really interesting point about Dukat. I like that a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody brings your own background to these shows, right? I mean, Timothy Leary in the 60s wrote a lot about LSD. Not that that's my thing, but one of the things that he wrote about was set and setting, right? The things that are inside you when you have an experience and the people who are around you or the world that is around you when you have the experience, like set and setting.
Yeah.
That affects how you interpret those things. And, you know, it's a very pragmatic point of view, which I really respected, right? And it's like, I believe that, and I've taken that as to something that I hold, like, I'm not going to separate my own personality and what I believe from what I view, and I'm going to interpret it through the lens of my life, and you're going to interpret it through the lens of your life. And as a physicist, you have a unique perspective that I need to listen to, right? Because you know about truths that I don't know about. Right. And
yeah.
And this person I was talking to, he was like, no, I'm here to tell you. Here's how it is. And I'm like, no, dude, that's not how we roll up in here. Yo, that's not what we're doing. So it was a good conversation. If people are interested, they can go look at my Twitter and read that interchange. It was a good and respectful conversation. And I'm glad we have it. OK, is there anything else we should talk about as far as Into the Forest I Go? Or was it really for you like the main point about the physics and the idea of doing the 133 jumps? Or is there anything else in that episode that was particularly significant for you?
Nope, just the science was freaking awesome.
Freaking awesome science I am all about. So then let's talk about another science episode. Let's talk about Eye of the Needle, season 1 of Voyager, episode 7. This is the one where Janeway and et al. Discover a micro, tiny, itsy-bitsy wormhole back to the Alpha Quadrant, and they're thinking about how they can get the ship through that wormhole, and they discover that it's too small to fly the ship through, and they contact a Romulan. Tell me why this episode is particularly meaningful to you. I have my suspicions, but I'm eager to see if they're confirmed or not.
Yeah, it's a few things. First of all, I'm constantly blown away that this is in the first, this is episode 7 in the first season, and it's a really good episode for being that early on in a Star Trek series. They are able to tap into the emotions of the crew really trying to get home. I think this is the first real opportunity that they see to get back to the Alpha Quadrant, so there's some level of desperation that they get across there. The fact that the Romulan were able to bring in Alpha Quadrant politics and the Romulan doesn't trust them, and then the science of having a wormhole is awesome as well. And I suspect we're not doing spoilers on this, but the big...
Yeah. FYI, this show is spoiled through the end of season one Discovery, and there's a warning at the front saying, look, we're going to talk about everything up to the end of season one Discovery, so
good. Awesome.
Feel free, go for it.
Okay, so the big, you know, plot twist that they throw at you is that when they transport the Romulan to Voyager, something's gone wrong, it's a little bit weird, they figure out that they've actually transported him through time as well. And that he is living in a time before Voyager even gets lost. And he goes back and he promises to not break the temporal laws, but to, you know, convey that Voyager is safe when the opportunity arises. And then they find out that he passed away before he had the opportunity to do that. And it's like emotionally devastating, as well as from a scientific point of view. It is so rare that a science fiction show uses a wormhole to travel through space and also mentions that they travel through time as well. You know, space and time are interchanged, are joined together, make up our universe. It's a four-dimensional universe. And so that so frequently gets overlooked when we talk about wormholes, and I love the fact that they brought that in. So on many levels, I think this is just one of my top favorite episodes of all time. It's emotionally a joy to watch, as well as scientifically.
One of the discussions I had with someone about this episode, actually in preparation for this podcast, was that we were talking about some of the science involved as complete idiotic amateurs. And I said to him, my friend, I said, well, you know, we're all time travelers. And he said, what? I said, well, I'm traveling through time right now. Aren't you? Unless you're frozen in amber, like some sort of, you know, prehistoric bug caught in an anthropologist's excavation of some kind. But I thought it was a very profound idea that it's really hard for people to get their brains wrapped around. That we're all traveling in four-dimensional space. And it's such a beautiful idea that even when we're sedentary, we're these dynamic creatures that are moving, and we have such energy within us. It's a profound and I dare say beautiful idea that I don't think people know about or appreciate. I don't know. What do you think of someone who actually studies this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a great idea, and that really was the epiphany, I would say, the driving force behind a lot of discoveries that happened in the early 1900s were people doing these thought experiments, and particularly Albert Einstein, who pioneered a lot of space-time and special relativity concepts, was just that, just sitting and thinking about the fact that we are constantly stepping forward through time. I can move left, I can move right, I can go up and down, I can go in whatever direction I choose, but I'm also constantly stepping forward in time. And not only am I always doing that, I have no control over it. The universe has removed my control over my ability to progress through the time dimension. And because math. but it is profound to think about. I enjoy that.
So one of the things we do on Trek Profiles is I create a series of provocations that I'm going to offer to you. And I always say this, I offer these provocations not as an incitement to put you to the test, but to give you something to respond to. So with that having been said, let me offer you these challenging statements and you respond to them as you will. Janeway seems to know more about physics than anybody else on the ship. How do you feel about that?
She's a science officer, born and bred, and then goes into being a captain. And while she's still on a science vessel, you know, she does defer her science from time to time. But, you know, as is with most Star Trek series, we're exposed to the senior officers on the crew. And so in whatever role the junior officers, you know, may have more physics knowledge, they either don't have the opportunity to show it or it flows up the chain to her through B'Elanna. So, you know, I love the fact that her backstory is being a scientist and that they do use that. And I think that that's really cool.
A decaying wormhole. Is that a thing?
Theoretically, yes. But so there's nothing in science saying that can't exist, but we've never detected them. We've never detected a wormhole. You know, we do know that black holes and other objects like that can grow in mass. We're trying to study them, especially with their detections of gravitational waves to see if they decay. We know they emit gravitational waves, particularly when they collide, and they lose mass and energy that way. So there's nothing in science saying that you can't have a decaying wormhole, but we've never detected one, let alone a wormhole itself.
So I'm going to be horribly self-indulgent. I hope you and the listeners will forgive me. How could the galaxy be divided into four quadrants? It seems random, arbitrary, and capricious. Is there a stellar cartographical method that seems more reasonable to you than that, or not?
So I think having the black hole in the center of our galaxy be the zero point is good. And it is in the Star Trek universe and in this universe. That when you're talking about the quadrants, that the center is at this black hole. But where those quadrants are, I mean, I remember a galaxy chart of Star Trek that I saw that I use sometimes, I think from a video game, that has Earth kind of right in the middle of the alpha and beta quadrants. There's also, you know, arguments where all of those lie. So breaking it into quadrants, sure. I mean, if you got to choose one way to do it, I think certainly from like a distance perspective, it makes sense. I think the galaxy is vast. It is certainly, you know, hard for us to comprehend. The stars that we're able to see with our eyes are only the very closest ones to us. And so this idea that you would have the delta quadrant being the diagonal quadrant to you and being so unobtainably far away is entirely valid. So, you know, I don't know if there are official ways to, you know, chart stars from Earth being the center point just because of what we can see. The issue is that there's so much dust and gas along the plane of the galaxy. And remember, our galaxy is flat and we live in this flat plane. And so if we're trying to look across to other quadrants, as it were, we can't even see them because they're so dusty. There's so much dust in between us. And so if we really wanted to chart it out, it would require traveling there. So I'm all right with it. We'll let it go.
Fair enough. As I watched the episode in preparation for this, I really like the way that Kes and Janeway talk about the Doctor. Kes thinks that the crew thinks he doesn't exist and that he's being bullied when he appears. And she wants to stop the bullying. And Janeway, she doesn't actually shut down Kes and just say, you know, shut up and go back to your station. But she actually hears what she has to say. I thought it was a really interesting point of view. Talk to me about your opinion of holographic rights.
That's interesting. Another episode that I enjoy is the Measure of a Man episode, the one where they discuss if Data has rights. And I think they made Janeway be more conflicted than, like, say, Pulaski was in Next Gen. But I think that as the Doctor developed and grew as a character, you know, we talk about this idea of the singularity with artificial intelligence, where an artificial intelligence is able to decide and teach itself what it wants to learn. And I do think that we will get to that point. I don't know when it's going to be. But I think once we reach that point, that's when we have to have that discussion. And, you know, the holographic Doctor really is an AI. And I think Voyager does explore a lot of it in a really good way, especially, you know, there are episodes where the Doctor makes his holographic family so he can try to learn. And he makes this perfect family that never fights and then makes a realistic family. And it's a lot harder for him and he doesn't like it and kind of learns a lot of lessons that way. And then we also have the discussion of Fairhaven, which, while goofy on the front end, you know, Janeway is able to have a relationship in Fairhaven, and she has not let herself have a relationship before. And one of the things that she does in that relationship is, at the end of the first Fairhaven episode, she cuts off her access to change the programming for that character. And I think that's profound, because you do have that power. And another great episode that I'm forgetting the name of it, Latent Image, is when the Doctor has a logical break and Janeway has to reprogram him. And he feels incredibly violated by that. And when they undo the change, he breaks again. And just this discussion of trying to keep an AI functional while realizing that they have flaws that could break them, and he's a necessary part of the crew, and how you deal with that, I think is profound and fascinating and one of the best qualities of Star Trek.
Can you be rude to an AI?
Well, that requires you to figure out if an AI has feelings. Now, if
we're
asking
about
me,
the Doctor and Voyager here, yeah.
Yep. And so in the context of the Doctor and Voyager, yeah, you could be rude to the Doctor. because we established that the Doctor feels feelings, that he feels abandoned. He doesn't like, especially in the first season when people are walking out and leaving him on and he doesn't have any control over his programming, he feels frustrated. And so in that context, yes, absolutely. I think these days, with our current technology, we can feel like we're being rude. I have definitely yelled at my phone. I have been rude to my personal assistant on my phone when I'm trying to do a chat and it keeps screwing it up. When I'm trying to voice dictate a chat when I'm on the road and it gets it wrong and I yell at it. So I'm not nice to it, but we haven't established that they have feelings. So I'm okay with that right now.
Talk to me about the idea of beaming through a wormhole and how much energy is 37 megajoules. Is that like enough to cook toast lightly, or is that enough to like obliterate the Earth?
It's on the lower scale for sure. Megajoules is not an insane amount of energy.
Cooking toast lightly?
Yeah, we can go with that. Cooking toast burntly. We'll go with that.
All right. And beaming through a wormhole. Talk to me about the physics of that.
The physics of that, if you were to... So beaming through a wormhole is basically like traveling into a black hole. There's incredible space-time distortions that happen around a wormhole. It's essentially a black hole with another end. And so you have a huge distortion of space-time. And so even as you're trying to maybe send a signal through a wormhole, it's going to get incredibly Doppler shifted. Now, what you would hope, and that's where you your frequency gets stretched. It's the same phenomenon as hearing the pitch of a siren increase as it comes towards you and decrease as it goes away from you. The same thing would happen, but to a very extreme degree going into and out of a wormhole. And so that same thing would happen. You kind of hope slash figure slash shrug and say it's resolved on the other side. So we can let that go, and that kind of works. And then the idea of sending particles through gets even harder because they would be distorted as well. But there's a scientific phenomenon we call spaghettification.
Very technical term, it sounds like.
Yes. That happens when you have these extreme distortions in space-time because it's extreme distortions in gravity. And so one part will be feeling a lot higher gravitational pull than another part, and it gets stretched apart. And so if you're sending particles through, it could tear them up. In black holes, you know, we suspect that it does tear them apart. And
well,
so
what about waves?
In terms of...
So would a transporter be a wave-based technology or a particle-based technology? Because if you're beaming through it, it's one or the other. If I understand it right, please
yeah.
Correct me if I have it wrong.
No, you bring up an excellent point. There's actually within
Star
Trek...
Wow.
You do.
Awesome.
because in Star Trek canon, it's actually kind of split on how transporters work. Whether you are breaking down something into its fundamental particles, recording where those particles were, sending a signal to a receiving pad, and then rebuilding out of new material those particles. Or... it's breaking down those fundamental particles and sending the particles themselves. Now,
right, so I'm going to stop you right here, and, yeah. I'm going to ask you a yes or no question, and we didn't prep this ahead of time, so I'm just going to ask you yes or no. Transporter, a suicide machine, yes or no?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. There you go.
You did. I hope you capture the long delay in my answer there.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I have no expectations of what you were going to say. That's the joy of Star Trek, right? Is that this show enables people to think about things which are bigger than themselves, whether it's how they want to be, what kind of person they want to be, or about the universe and how the natural order is arrayed in the universe for us to experience, right? In a new way. So I'm totally okay with either answer, but I just thought it was a good opportunity to offer you a question to respond to. So I appreciate that, Dr. Aaron. Thank you so much.
Of course. Yes. And like I said, it kind of, some of that is totally dependent on which side of the canon that you fall into. Whether it does send the signal of where your particles should go or whether it's sending your particles. And Star Trek canon contradicts itself with that. It gives both scenarios. So pick and choose.
All right. So I'm not going to ask you the question then, and whether or not that's a distinction that actually matters if you're going through the transporter. So we will leave that as an exercise for our listeners to actually figure that out. Another episode that the M5 told me that we should talk about is Counterpoint, Voyager Season 5, Episode 10, the most delightful part of which is the incredibly puffy-nosed alien lizard wormhole scientist Torret. I love the puffy-nosed Torret with like a burning intensity with his puffy nose. It's fantastic. Tell me why the M5 said we should talk about this episode. Why does it matter to you?
So this is much more on the personal heartstring episode than the science brain of mine. I love this episode. I have such a hard time with commitment that I hesitate to call it my favorite episode. But every time I watch it, I'm like, oh my God, if I had a favorite episode, this would be it. Because
you committed to going to study in Scotland in another part of the world for a PhD. So yeah. You've got some commitment there. That's a big deal.
Yeah. Or, you know, bravado, whatever. That was 10 years ago. but yeah, no, And I think part of the reason I love this episode because of Janeway. It's a Janeway episode. And it shows, we get to see her be excited about science and develop a romantic relationship in the process. I think we see a lot of her armor go down that we haven't seen. And I don't think we really do see. Maybe the closest we see to that is Fairhaven. And it comes down because she has a scientific problem to solve. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to analyze the frequencies of these wormholes so they can figure out where they're appearing. And she just sees this as a problem. And I think that I personally relate to it because that is the type of problem I would want to sink my teeth into. And I would be pouring coffee at 3 a.m. trying to figure out this problem. And the bigger part of it is that she finds a companion who seems to be equally interested in it. And
the fellow Kashyyyk.
Yes. I always remember, I'm like, it's a planet in Star Wars.
Yes, it's the home planet of the Wookiees.
You know, you also see, because her shields are down, you know, there's just some really funny moments with the crew because they all kind of know what's going on. And she also kind of knows that they kind of know what's going on. And there are just a lot of like little side glances with that. But then ultimately, you know, he betrays her and there's, you know, kind of a romantic scene and then she gets betrayed. But then you find out that she kind of was always on to him, that she kind of always had the upper hand. And I really like that, that even though she was able to be very vulnerable and allow herself to have those romantic feelings, she never let her guard down. And I really like that. I just think it's a great episode. It's just, it hits every, everything that I like personally. I can understand why it's not on, I don't think, anyone's favorite list. Some people mention it, but yeah.
That's not what this show is about. This show is about you, Dr. Aaron. And if you think it's an episode that's meaningful to you, there is no one who shall gainsay you on that topic.
Thank you.
You know, it's about whatever you choose. And if you choose it, then that was the correct choice. Yes. And that's why I name these episodes after my guests. So it's your decision. But the question I have for you, and this might be outside your area, so tell me how you think about it. There's this interesting discussion in the episode about point versus counterpoint leading to the wormhole and the idea that science is related to music and music is related to science. Tell me what your thoughts are as an actual legit 100% astrophysicist about this, because I will tell you that I've heard musicians weigh in on this and I know what their point of view is. And I'm not saying this right or wrong because I'm not in any position to say, but I'm curious to hear what you have to think about it.
So as someone who's a scientist, but also a passionate person of the arts, I guess, I would say that there is science behind music, but that doesn't make it any less beautiful. It doesn't mean that it can't also be art and beautiful. I think that they can coexist together. I think that there are, you know, you can break down some things in science to say, you know, that you have points and counterpoints, you have different harmonics, you have different, you know, these very scientific concepts about frequencies that can explain why some music is more appealing than others. But at the end of the day, you're never going to be able to explain like why you cry when you're listening to Beethoven, you know, or something like that. And there's also a lot of research done into, you know, the parts of our brain that gravitate towards art tend to gravitate towards science as well. You know, speaking personally, I play, you know, half a dozen instruments. And so I am also, I'm not a musician. These have all been like very level one instruments. I think the piano is probably the only one I've kept with the longest, but I was drawn to music in the same way that I'm drawn to science. And that is another point that I like in the episode, that they do talk about music and there is a lot of music in the episode. And it's a cool discussion to have.
M5 tells me we should talk about The Way of the Warrior, the two-parter from Deep Space Nine. Kira and Jadzia in Arthurian dresses caused me to basically lose my tell me about why the M5 thinks this is an episode we should talk about.
For me, this captured a lot of my favorite parts of Deep Space Nine in one two-parter. That, you know, when we were talking about rewatching, if I don't have the emotional or time capacity to rewatch all of Deep Space Nine, I will watch this two-parter episode because I think that this is all the negotiation. So this is the negotiations where they think that there's a Cardassian uprising happening and the Klingons suspect that it's a changeling who's coming in and inciting this uprising. And the Federation disagrees with that. And basically the treaty between the Federation and the Klingons come to a head in this episode. And then this was also the first time that we see Deep Space Nine having been retrofitted as an actual war machine.
Yeah, and it's
which
crazy.
Is spectacular. And so just as like a sci-fi viewer who also loves space battles, this is an awesome space battle. And I think it brings in great Klingon politics. You know, we have all the issues with Martok and the leaders and Worf's relationship. This is Worf's first appearance.
So hold right there. I want to ask you a question about that. Is Martok a changeling?
Is Martok a changeling? No.
In this episode, because he is in Deep Space Nine, we learn later that Martok is replaced by a changeling. So in episode,
okay,
is the Martok we see in this episode, is the Martok we see a changeling?
So they never established that. But I think you're right. Like, it is kind of hinted at. And I would, you know, seeing the personality in this episode and seeing Martok's personalities in others, I think that's hard to say. I still kind of lean toward no, just because of the agony over the decisions and the heated discussions that happen. But that being said, now you've like sown a seed of doubt and I have to go rewatch the episode again.
And that is not a bad thing. That is totes okay, because watching more Star Trek is an A number one okay thing to do. Question for you. Jadzia walks into Worf's holodeck program while it's in progress. Is this like a horrible thing to do, terribly cheeky, very flirty, or a horrible thing to do under all circumstances and in all times and in all places?
I would say horrible circumstances under all times and all places, because I know what kind of holodeck programs that I would be running, and I don't want people walking in on those.
Okay, we'll leave that there.
No, I think, you know, especially in through all of Star Trek, when they talk about holodeck episodes, they really are the crew's personal time, 100%. It's an opportunity to read a book, to play a video game, to watch a TV series that you love and engage in. And when, when those, sometimes they're shared, but there's always some embarrassment with it. You know, you talk about our man Bashir and Garrett.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And, you know, his 007 program. We talk about, you know, even though Fairhaven was open to everyone, when Janeway gets busted flirting with the bartender when she's in costume, she's embarrassed. You know, there's so many episodes where people get embarrassed by having their holodeck programs exposed or interrupted that I just say that, like, you know, yeah, I'm right there with them. I wouldn't want someone walking into mine. I don't have anything in particular in mind, but, you know, it's a holodeck.
So, you know what always comes to mind? Did you ever see the documentary by Denise Crosby, Trekkies?
I did, yeah.
So when Gabriel Kerner is being interviewed and he's in his teens and he's with his dad and they're in the middle of the interview and all of a sudden the phone rings and he picks up the phone and he's like, this is not a good time. And he hangs up the phone and like he slams it down. That's exactly what it would be. Like they presaged the entire thing right there in that scene. Right.
For sure.
My wife, who is, you know, the best lady in the world, whom I love more than anything else. If I'm playing something and I'm in the middle of, you know, whatever idiotic 12-year-old thing I'm involved with, and she like walks in the middle of it, I'm like, I'm busy now. You know, exactly. Now is not the time.
Exactly. I have a friend that her and I are always joking because we play a lot of BioWare games, Dragon Age and Mass Effect, and we replay them a lot. And we always just joke about our significant partners being in the room when there's like, you know, intimate scenes with our characters and other characters, and just this awkwardness of being like, should I pause the game? Should I play through it, but like talk to him so it seems like I'm not super interested in it? Should I just save it and come back to it later?
Like, never
this is,
pause
imagine
the game.
That.
Never
the
pause the game.
Yeah.
Continue on. And be, you know what? I mean, look. My wife is, you know, the best lady in the world that I know. But she's not into Star Trek, right? And I was like, look, hon, I had Star Trek before I had you. This is who I am. Yeah. I was like this when you married me. You know, you have interest in A, B, C, and D. And yeah. I have interest in X, Y, and Z. And that's how we roll up in here. And we're going to be a, you know, the thing that makes a burrito delicious is that it's not all the same inside.
Yeah.
And yeah. That's what we're going to do.
Yeah. No, I like that for sure. Yeah.
Let me ask you some other provocations about this episode. We're going to move on pretty quickly, though. But my favorite scene from the entire two-parter was Odo and Worf on the promenade, having their little discussion.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the things that touches me, and I'll just respond to it, is just any scene where the actors get to act beautifully. And they're given something that's meaty. And I love it so much. But I'm curious to hear what you think.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, again, this is like one of the reasons I love this two-parter so much is because it encapsulates so much of Deep Space Nine that I like. And that's one of the things. Those little moments, if I could, you know, live anywhere, I'd live on Deep Space Nine. And it's because we've seen the quiet moments in Quark's bar. You know, we've seen the friendships build. We've seen those, like, heartfelt moments and children grow up. And I think that those discussions and those quiet moments and the really just, like you said, the actors act are fantastic. And I love that this episode was not rushed into a single episode. I think giving it the two-parter allowed those moments to happen and it gave more weight. I think it was a great way to bring Worf back. rather than just be like, hey, we need a ratings boost, so we're going to bring back a popular character. Not that that wasn't part of it, but they gave him genuine conflict, genuine issues to discuss. And his relationship with Starfleet and the Enterprise and Klingons and all of that, I really love.
Again, my own personal insanity. But the one thing that drives me crazy in the real world, you know, regular non-Star Trek, non-fandom stuff, is when I'm walking behind someone and they walk into a room and they just stop and they look around. And it's like I'm right behind them. That's what Worf does when he walks on a Deep Space Nine. And like you can see it in the episode. He walks on a Deep Space Nine out of his little shuttle. And, you know, he's got his, you know, equipment with him. And he just like stops and looks around. You know, and I'm like, dude, move. Like, move out of the way. Like, what is wrong with you? There are people trying to, you know, get their, you know, there are people trying to buy some Jumja sticks right behind you, dude. What you doing?
You know, just, right.
Anyway.
That's funny.
The M5 tells me that we should also talk about Darmok. Now, I want to point out that we're moving from an area of physics to an area of social science. So tell me why this particular episode is of interest to you as an astrophysicist and as a Star Trek fan.
I think that this episode encapsulates Star Trek possibly better than, again, I'm having problems committing, than I think any, as a standalone, than any other episode. When people who are not Star Trek fans or sci-fi fans or anything like that ask about Star Trek, I recommend that they watch this episode. And that has been mostly successful, purely because it's this idea that you are genuinely trying to communicate. It starts out as distrust and fear. And while before you're able to even express yourself to the other person, you can still learn to trust someone else and communicate without language. And then you are able to figure out their language, but in a way that teaches you more about them and just how our language is inextricably linked to the way we express ourselves and our culture and our identity. And I think it's just, it's a very intelligent episode. I think it's a very thought-provoking episode. And it's just a great story arc. I think that, you know, it's incredibly acted. This is one of those that is, I will watch standalone when I'm in the mood for it. You know, like I will just turn on Darmok because it just, it gives me hope for society and humanity in all the best ways that Star Trek does.
So you've made some interesting allusions to this idea that Darmok is the very best of Star Trek. Darmok is the kind of Star Trek that I'm interested in. It's the kind of Star Trek I like. What is Star Trek to you?
Star Trek for me is an allegory for where we can be the best that we can be. It's for, it puts in front of us challenges. It holds a mirror up to our prejudices, challenges us in many ways, but it also gives us hope for the future. And the fact that there is science associated with it is great, but what it means to me is that we are good, we are well-intentioned, we are flawed, but we will make it. And I love that idea, and that's why I fell in love with Star Trek, 100%.
If you've fallen in love with Star Trek, then it leads to this idea that Star Trek has had to have had some actual influence on your life. What would you say has been the influence of Star Trek in your life?
The influence of Star Trek in my life has been that it has challenged me and it has given me personal strength. When, again, going back to graduate school, it was there for me at the beginning. It was there with me through my friendships there. But really, it was with me at the end. And doing a doctorate is very, very hard. It's a lot of work and it's a lot of personal, it requires a lot of you personally, physically and emotionally and everything, because you're just, it's just you to do this. And it was very hard for me. Physics has never come easy to me. Math has never come easy to me. It's something I've learned because it's something I've been interested in, but it's always been hard. And I considered giving up multiple times, that it wasn't worth it. that it was requiring too much of me and that I ultimately didn't need it anymore. And when I reached that point, I rewatched Voyager and, you know, Captain Janeway's strength and her enthusiasm for science and her ability to lead told me what I heard in my mind was that if you want to be as awesome as this woman is, you got to do this degree. And, you know, what would Janeway do? She would do this. She would get through it. And I did. And I, you know, dedicated part of my thesis to Captain Janeway. I said that, you know, the strength and inspiration she gave me can barely be put into words. And it's true. And so, and that holds true throughout my life. I think that's just one snapshot. But I think that, you know, on a regular basis, I find myself having met family, having something to share with people, to share with strangers. It's like that family that you just haven't met yet. And it's given me an escape when I needed an escape. And it's a happy place to go.
The M5 is telling me I should ask you about the Scully effect. What's that?
So the Scully effect is a phenomenon that is just currently being studied. It has to do with women who have gotten into STEM because of Dana Scully. And
please define STEM.
Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So scientific fields, but that is mm-hmm. extended to technology, engineering, and mathematics. And it's women who have got into STEM because of Dana Scully, that there's a huge influx of women in the medical fields, in the FBI, and in the broader scientific fields who can directly point to Dana Scully as their inspiration. I consider myself lucky to be one of them because when, you may remember at the beginning of this episode, I said that I didn't watch Star Trek because I was too consumed with the X-Files, was because they had a redheaded scientist woman who was fighting aliens. And as a redheaded girl who liked science, that I was all about that. And at one point, they mentioned that Dana Scully did her undergraduate thesis on Einstein's twin paradox in astrophysics. And I thought, oh, that's cool. I looked up what astrophysics was in the dictionary, and I thought, that sounds awesome. I want to study that. You mean I can study space? And there's just a direct line between Dana Scully and me becoming an astrophysicist. And then, you know, Janeway plays a significant part in that as well. And the big lesson from that is that representation matters. You know, for me, it was a redheaded woman who donned a lab coat and fought aliens. But you never know what's going to resonate with another little kid who doesn't have any real mentors in a field they might be interested in.
Well, maybe that the sounds of our voices, yours and mine, Dr. Aaron, will reach some young girl out there. And it won't be the Scully effect. It'll be the McDonald effect. And I'm not talking about that Scottish restaurant. No. I'm talking about you. And maybe the fact that you've actually accomplished something in the real world, earning a PhD and actually being an astrophysicist in the real world, will inspire some young girl to study science, technology, coding, mathematics, some sort of STEM field. And maybe in 10 years, if I'm still doing this, I'll have somebody on and they'll say, no, I'm here because of the McDonald effect. And they'll tell me that. And so I think that that's a very, very positive and forward-thinking way to bring our show to a conclusion. What do you think about that?
I think that's great. And even if it's one person that I'm able to influence, then it's all worth it.
I've enjoyed talking with you, but the M5 is a very harsh taskmaster. And he's telling me that it's time for the Kobayashi Maru.
All right.
And the Kobayashi Maru is a challenging and difficult test, cunningly prepared by the M5 Multitronic Unit. Should you not only survive the test, but pass it as well, the M5 will award you an honorary Star Trek title on behalf of my podcast. Are you ready, Dr. Aaron?
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
M5, load the Kobayashi Maru simulation and prepare to record the good doctor's responses. Dr. Aaron, you are going on a little trip to Bajor. Which province are you most looking forward to seeing, Rakantha or Dakur?
Dakur.
Temba, his arms open, or Sokath, his eyes open?
Tembath, his arms open.
You're thirsty. Two fine libations are on offer. Sluggo Cola or Muskin Seed Punch. What do you have?
Muskin Seed Punch.
Who is more annoying, the very needy and demanding Elon of Troyes or the smarmy and cultish Luddite Alexis?
Elon of Troyes.
You are the science officer on a Starfleet ship. The captain tells you that you can choose the next science mission. Shall we investigate a pulsar or a stellar black hole? What's your pleasure?
Pulsar.
Simulation complete. M5, please compute the results and tell us if our guest has passed the Kobayashi Maru.
Analyzing results.
Dr. Aaron, I am pleased to tell you the M5 has calculated that you have not only survived, but passed the Kobayashi Maru simulation. Congratulations!
Hooray!
And now, the M5, who has analyzed your answers, will award you an honorary Star Trek title on behalf of our podcast. M5, what title shall we award our guest?
Dr. Aaron is awarded the title of Director of Stellar Cartography for the Federation Astronomical Committee.
Yeah! Maybe then I can have some control over the quadrants. And the
That's right. You could totally, because where's the line between alpha and gamma, right? I mean,
exactly.
How do you even, it doesn't matter what the center is. You still have to pick a line. You
exactly.
could be in charge.
Now I am in charge. That's my problem now. So thanks.
You are. I'm signing up for your TED Talks right now. Dr. Aaron, please tell people how they should get in touch with you if they want to continue the conversation.
You can find me mostly on Twitter at Dr. Aaron Mack, on Facebook as well at the Tattooed Gravity Girl. Also on my website is aaronpmacdonald.com. That's where you'll find my convention appearances and other information for getting in touch with me.
Fantastic. And I'm going to put some full show notes on trekprofiles.com. So if you're interested in any of the articles or other things we've talked about on the show, you'll be able to find those links all on trekprofiles.com. Dr. Aaron, thank you so much for being part of the Trek Profiles podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This was a blast.
Here ends this installment of the Trek Profiles podcast. And before we offer a Trek quote to close this episode, I'd like to remind you that you may send us your oaths of allegiance, cute cat videos, or please to make it all stop to feedback@trekprofiles.com or on Facebook or Twitter at Trek Profiles. Anything you send us may be used on the show or swallowed by a random stellar anomaly. This week, I leave you with a quote from Torat, the puffy-nosed scientist from the Delta Quadrant, who in the Voyager episode Counterpoint said, quote, "Federations, Imperiums, why do you people feel such a need to align yourselves with such monolithic organizations?" Close quote. Thanks for listening, and live long and prosper.